This morning, we have arrived at the last chapter of John's Gospel, and that is the 21st chapter, and Jesus' third post-resurrection appearance to his gathered church. And his attention is focused upon his church and the future of his church and the provisions of his church. This should not surprise us, as we've seen previously. We saw this in chapter 20, verses 21 through 23. Jesus is entrusting his legacy to these few disciples. And it would be possible for Jesus to vanish from history if they should prove to be unfaithful, if they should fail to take his message and to perpetuate it to the next generation and successive generations on into the future. So he's being very careful to underscore certain lessons that they must learn, certain understanding that they must have in order for them to faithfully and fruitfully carry out the tasks that he is assigning them. And in the 21st chapter, there is an emphasis on leadership, the tasks of leadership. And he identifies two tasks in verses 1 through 17. Verses 1 through 14 are texts for today. He identifies their task as that being of fishers of men. That is, they are to be evangelists. And then in 15 through 17, they are to be shepherds of the sheep. That is, they are to be pastors. In other words, they are to save sinners and they are to sanctify the saints. The constant theme throughout this whole section is that theme of their complete, their absolute dependence upon Christ for all things. It's only as he provides the resources that they need will they be able to live the Christian life, and will they be able to successfully carry on his gospel. So what I propose to do this morning is to just provide a running narrative of verses 1 through 14, explaining as we go, and then drawing out the meaning at the end. So let's look then at verses 1 through 14 and this third appearance of Jesus. Verse 1, after this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, which is another name for the Sea of Galilee. They are there in Galilee because that's where Jesus told them to go, that once he was raised from the dead, he would meet with them in Galilee. It was Galilee where most of his earthly ministry took place, most of his teaching, most of his miracles took place. So he's told them to go there. That's where they are. They are by the Sea of Tiberias, that is Galilee. And he revealed himself in this way. Verse 2, Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of the disciples were together. So a total of seven of the disciples are named. Verse 3, Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing. And they said to him, we will go with you. And they went out and got into the boat. Stopping there for a minute, there's been some discussion among the commentators as to whether or not this is a faithless act on the part of Peter and then the disciples in following him, interpreting his words, I am going fishing, as with a note of finality, like I'm through with this discipleship business. I've had enough of it. This has caused a lot of suffering, and I'm terribly confused about what all is going on. And so I'm just going back to fishing. Life was much simpler then. I think many Christians can understand that outlook. Life was fine until I became a Christian, and I was promised peace and joy, the solution to my problems, and in fact, it seems like my problem just began when I became a Christian. And so the words of Peter have been understood in that sense. Like, I've had enough. I'm going back to fishing. I'm going back to my own profession, what I really know. Most of the commentators, however, don't agree with that. They do not read Peter's words in that way. Instead, what they would have us understand, and I think that they're correct, is that they need to continue to eat. They need to continue to work. There's no sense sitting around being idle, and so they're doing what they know to do. They're going to fish. They're going to catch fish. They're going to be able to sell some of those fish. They're going to be able to eat those fish. So in the absence of any other direction, they're just carrying on of life, carrying on with life, and putting food on the table. And then at the end of verse 3, it says, they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. And I think that this is a providentially important, providentially ordered, providentially intentional. Why would that be? Well, Jesus wants them to go out and catch nothing. Why? Because he wants to teach them at a new level the extent to which they are dependent upon him. Peter says, I'm going fishing. This is what we know how to do. And Jesus is going to teach them the extent of their dependence by the fact that they're going to go out and fish and catch nothing, and then as he directs them, they're going to be able to catch things. So that even here in this so-called secular realm, where they, in fact, have some competence and some expertise, they are dependent upon him in this, and therefore the lesson will be, you are dependent upon me in all things. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's continue with the narrative. Verse 4, just as day was breaking, the morning has arrived. Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. This may be, as part of this common theme, that it was difficult for them to recognize him. He was the same, but he was different. And so they see him, and they don't initially recognize him. It's only later that they do. Or it could just be that because it's sunrise, it's still relatively dark, and it's difficult to see who the person is that's standing on the shore. Verse 5, Jesus said to them, children, do you have any fish? Children, is that a term of diminutive is what I mean to say. Is this a bit of an insult, calling them children? Probably not. Probably this is the kind of language that men use among themselves, like in England. Men will address each other as the lads are getting together, or in Ireland that the boys are getting together, or here in this country the guys are getting together. It's just the way that men refer to themselves, and so there's probably nothing terribly unusual about this. So he says, children, do you have any fish? That is, have you caught any fish? And they answered him, no. They've been utterly unsuccessful. Verse 6, he said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. Now, in one sense, this is not unusual either. It was not uncommon for someone to be standing on the shore that would be somewhat elevated from the level of the water, and so have some perspective from which to see the movement of schools of fish. And so somebody on the shore might say, look, the fish are over there, you know, row over there, and then cast your nets. And it may be that nothing more than that is what is happening at this time. Kind of a parallel example would be in football. You put your defensive coordinator and your offensive coordinator up into the booth in an elevated position where they're able to see the whole play develop. Whereas when you're on the flat ground on the sideline, it just looks like a mass of bodies and it's hard to tell exactly what's going on. But when you're at a higher level, you can see where the players are standing and how the plays are developing. And so you have a sharper perspective. And that may be what is happening here. And their willingness to comply with the instruction. So they cast their net. Verse 6 continues. And now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of the fish. And when this happens, at that moment, there's this moment of recognition. They realize who they're dealing with. Why? Well, because in what's recorded back in Luke chapter 5, there was a similar occasion where they had been out all night and they caught nothing, and Jesus comes to the shore and he tells them to go back out and cast again. And Peter, echoing his own perspective that he's something of an expert about fishing, says, even though we've been out all night and already have taken care of that and done all that could be done, we'll go back out because you tell us to. And they do, and they cast their nets, and they haul this vast catch, and the nets even break under the weight of it. So this event then sparks a recollection in the minds of the disciples that this is Jesus. And the first one to recognize this, in keeping with the character of John, who refers to himself as the disciple that Jesus loved, out of modesty, he never names himself, recognizes that it's Jesus. And then also in keeping with the individual personalities of the men, Peter then is the first one into action. As he will put on his outer coat as a sign of respect and not just go to shore stripped down to his gym trunks, effectively, with all that he would have on. He puts on and then jumps into the water. Peter has this characteristic of impetuosity about him. And so as soon as he realizes upon John's comment that that's Jesus, he immediately heads to shore, throws on the outer coat, and jumps into the water and begins to wade to shore. So it says in verse 7, the disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. The other disciples, having more sense about them, came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but were about 100 yards off. Notice all these eyewitness details that reinforce our conviction of the authenticity of the account. Peter putting on the outer garment, the opposite of what you'd expect for somebody who's about to jump into the sea. He puts on the outer garment. He had been stripped for work, throwing himself into the sea, even though they were only 100 yards off. In other words, he completely forgets himself and the fish and the net and the boat. So anxious is he to come to shore and to encounter Jesus directly face to face. Verse 9, when they had got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. So Jesus has prepared breakfast. How did he prepare it? Well, we're not told how he prepared it. Presumably, he could just have said breakfast and breakfast appeared. The one who multiplied the loaves is capable of doing that. Or it may have been by prior arrangements. We don't know. Jesus in verse 10 said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you have just caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net, that is, he organized with the other disciples the hauling of the net ashore, full of large fish, 153 of them. Again, more eyewitness details. These were not small fish, these were large fish. There were not 152 or 154 fish, but typical of fishermen, he actually counts the fish. There were 153 fish. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. That's a detail that's thrown in because, again, the recollection of the previous occasion in Luke 5 when the nets did tear. This time, the nets are not torn. And Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now, none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. That's a very curious verse. Because why does it bother to say that they didn't dare to ask and then say that they knew? Well, presumably because they actually wanted to ask. In other words, they're still perplexed. It's something that's hard to understand, I think, from our distance. But they're still confused about what's going on. They've seen the crucifixion. They've seen the empty tomb. They've seen two appearances. Now there's a third appearance. They really can't put it all together. There's an element of confusion with them. And what they want to do is they want to ask, "Is it really you?" But they knew they shouldn't ask that. That's what some of them asked on the Emmaus Road. And Jesus responded to them by saying, "Oh, foolish and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have said." So they don't want to be on the end of one of those rebukes again, but they really do want more in the way of confirmation. So they know it's him, but they want an addition. They want Jesus to say, "It is I. I'm here." But they don't dare ask. They don't say, "Is it really you?" Because of this ongoing element of confusion with them, which, is, by the way, is the reason why he continues to give them instruction about what the future holds for them, as he did at the end of chapter 20. Verse 13, Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them. I think they were frozen in place. So he already invited them to breakfast. They didn't, but they're just standing there staring at him. And so he then brings the food to them, came and took the bread and gave it to them. And so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So what is then the meaning of this third encounter? Well, I think we need to know that this is not just breakfast with the guys. You know, they're not just having a little cookout on the seashore. Jesus is delivering these final lessons to them. Twice he has met with them in what appear to be religious assemblies. Now he is meeting with them in the workplace in order to make the point at a deeper level, teach the lesson at a greater depth than he has up to this point. And the lessons are threefold. Number one, he's teaching them their dependence upon him in all things. They need his wisdom. They need his guidance. They need his provision. And they need it even in the mundane things of life, even in the areas of their greatest competence and experience. I have this game that I play with our grill masters out at Point Pleasant during the summers, where I walk up to the assembly building and I look over at their smoking grill and I say, do y'all need any help? Can I help you with anything? Posing as the expert. Is there some advice you need about grilling the meat? And either by the smirk with which they look at me or by direct answer, they say to the effect, you just get on with preaching what you know about, and we'll handle the cooking. We know how to do this, and we have no confidence in what you know about grilling. So just go on, go preach, leave us alone. We'll take care of grilling the meat. Well, I think that there's an element of that. I think that was what we saw in Luke 5, and no doubt there's remnants of that still in the disciples. They're fishermen. They know how to fish. They know what they're doing. So what Jesus did was show them, you really don't know that much about what you're doing. You need my help. You need my assistance. You need me to come onto the scene and say, cast your nets on the other side of the boat for you to have a fruitful harvest of fish. You are dependent upon me. You need me. You need me even in the areas of your competence and knowledge. You need me in everything that you do. In other words, the overall lesson here is that of John 15:5, where Jesus says, I am the vine and you are the branches, and apart from me, you can do nothing. Now, to what extent is that true? It's absolutely true. As the Apostle Paul tells the Athenians, from God we have life and breath and all things. It doesn't matter if you're a believer or unbeliever or a weak believer or a strong believer. It doesn't matter who you are. The fact of the matter is, we depend upon God for life. We depend upon God for breath. We depend upon him for everything. We don't take another step. We don't breathe another breath of air. Apart from his enabling us to do so, our dependence is absolute. That's the sense in which there's no such thing as a self-made man or self-made woman. We are dependent upon God at every moment, in every situation, in every circumstance of life. We are dependent. That is the lesson that he is teaching them, and that we are accountable in all things. Now, this is an important lesson because most religions are, whether we're talking about the ancient religions or even most of the world religions today, religion is a little category. that is separated from all the other categories. It's a little box over here, and it consists of ritual and ceremony and forms of words and so forth, but it doesn't really interact with, it doesn't intersect with anything else in life. This was true of the ancient religions. There was religion, and then there was morality, and the one didn't have anything to do with the other. You go through the rituals and the ceremonies, and you take care of religion, and you satisfy the gods, and then it has no impact upon moral behavior at all. And in the 20th century, we've seen this with Eastern religions, where there can be extraordinary barbarism and brutality on the part of very religious people, the terrorist attacks and so forth, that we've seen right up into the present in the name of religion. Because religion doesn't forbid such a thing, because there's the religion, and then there's behavior, then there's what one does out in the world, and these are seen as separate spheres. There's what I do in church, and then there's what I do out in the workplace, and in business, and on the ball field, and in the community, and these two are thought to be separate. And what Jesus is teaching them is, no, you are accountable to me everywhere. You are dependent upon me everywhere. Christianity does not remain contained in the walls of the church. You are at all points dependent upon me. You are at all points accountable to me. And I'm underscoring that point. If you've missed it thus far, I'm emphasizing it right now by instructing you in how to catch fish, the one thing you think you know how to do. Even there, you need my strength. You need my power. You need my wisdom, because apart from me, you can do nothing. And so, disciples, even though Jesus is ascending up into heaven, we must continue to be dependent upon him. We must continue to look to his provision if we're to survive, even in the ordinary things of life. So that's number one. Number two lesson is that this is especially true in connection with the assigned task. What's the assigned task? Well, on this occasion, it is that of being fishers of men. So I think it's right to see this as an enacted parable. They are fishing for physical fish, but there's a larger point, a spiritual point. Fishing, after all, is a metaphor of evangelism. So, for example, Mark 4:19, Jesus says to the disciples, from now on, you will be fishers of men. Luke 5:10, you will be catching men. In other words, human souls. In other words, he is underscoring the task of evangelism. What your task will be once I leave, and I leave responsibility for the ongoing proclamation of the gospel, what you will be doing, employing this metaphor, is you will be casting gospel nets in order to draw lost souls into the ark, into the boat of salvation. He's underscoring the importance of the evangelistic imperative, if we can call it that. He wants them to understand the importance of outreach. He wants them to understand the importance of evangelism. I think that a fair observation is to recognize that there are churches that are very good at evangelism, and then there are churches that are very good at building up the saints. There are seeker-friendly churches, and there are finder-friendly churches. Going after the ones who are seeking, but then nourishing the ones that are found. Those are two of the tasks of the church. And churches like ours tend to be good at the latter and perhaps not as good at the former. So we think in terms of what the former president of Westminster Seminary, Ed Clowney, referred to as a doxological evangelism. So it is evangelistic outreach just to conduct a service. That's true. To open the doors and open those doors to anyone who comes in and to know they will hear the gospel being sung and read and preached and prayed and displayed in the sacraments. So that's part of our evangelistic task. We fulfill that task, and I believe we do a pretty decent job of it. And the Apostle Paul says about the Corinthian church that in a proper worship service, when the unbeliever wanders in, they will be convicted by all. They will be called to account by all. The secrets of their hearts will be revealed, and they will fall down and say, "Truly, God is among you." That would be the deduction they'll make on the basis of what they observe of the people of God involved in sound worship services. That's 1 Corinthians 14, verses 24 and 25. All right. Still, Jesus is emphasizing the importance of evangelism, outreach as churches. We're to be fishers of men. And I believe that's true of the church as a whole, but I think it's true of individuals as well. We are all called to be ambassadors for Christ. When are we his ambassadors? All the time. Every moment of every day, wherever we are. Now, to be able to do that, we must be dependent upon Christ. We need his strength. But that doesn't relieve us of the responsibility to be involved in that activity. We are his ambassadors in the schoolyard. We are his ambassadors in the workplace. We are his ambassadors in the community. We are representing Christ. We are the only Bibles that many people will read. And so we need to be able to give an account of the hope that is within us. At the very least, we can do the Andrew and the Peter thing, but just say, "Come and see." We can bring people into our church where we know they're going to hear the proclamation of the gospel. But we ourselves are to be evangelistically minded and be thinking about what kind of impact is my light having on the people that are around me at work or around me in the classroom or around me on the playground. Am I having a positive impact for the sake of the gospel? Even if I'm not a preacher, what kind of an impact is my life having? So let your light shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Our lives are meant to make a difference evangelistically. And so Jesus is making that point to the disciples, and as he makes it to them, he makes it to us. We are to be about the business of casting gospel nets in order to draw into the ark of salvation those who are dead in their trespasses and sin. It's not the only metaphor for our task. We're just seeking to save the lost. So the idea of being lost, we're to be like physicians for the sick. These are other metaphors for gospel ministry. But this is an important one for us to understand, this positive kind of casting of the nets in order to draw into the kingdom of God those who are apart from it. And then thirdly, Jesus is teaching us about our dependence upon his spiritual resources. For this, I think the breakfast needs to be considered. Jesus provides them with food, with physical food. But again, these point to larger spiritual lessons. What would that larger spiritual lesson be? Well, that we don't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And that we are not able to carry out the ministry without gospel resources. And we make a great mistake if we, as individuals, if we, as a church, fall into a pattern of thinking like that we are wise enough on our own to run the church, to live the Christian life wisely. We make a fatal mistake if we think we are self-sufficient, although we could trust in our own strength. This is the pride that comes before the fall, to think that, well, I'm invulnerable. I'm strong enough to resist temptation, whether it's the temptation to unbelief or the temptation to succumb to the sins of the flesh, to think that I'm strong enough, to think that I'm wise enough, to think that we as a church, we can build an organization. We know how to run a business, and we treat the church as a business and as an organization like any others, and think that if we do so, we'll have success and a God-pleasing ministry. And we fall back on our own resources, our own strengths, our own wisdom, our own programs, our own facilities. We just put up the walls of the church and we think, well, then we know how to build these buildings and we know how to run these programs. And Jesus, by supplying them with what they think they know how to do, they know how to build a campfire, they know how to cook food over a fire, but he supplies that for them. Why? So that they would understand that they need his resources. Now, they're not passive in any of this, so I don't want to overstate the case. When Jesus says, cast the nets on the right side of the boat, they have to actually cast the nets. Jesus doesn't cast the nets for them. They have to actually drag the nets to shore. He doesn't do that for them. And interestingly, toward the end of our passage, he supplies the breakfast, but then he asks them to bring some more fish so that they bring their contribution, so that he's not teaching them that you need to just sit back and wait and let me do everything because I'm in charge around here. No, they have a part to play. But what they're to understand is that at every point, what they do is dependent upon what he does. And apart from his work, our work is utter futility. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Psalm 127:1. Jesus says, I will build my church. And yet he uses us to build it. But we're tempted at times to get the order wrong, to think, well, we're the one who's building the church. No, Jesus is building his church, and he's working through us. And for us to do it properly and do it well, we need his wisdom. We need his strength. We need to know that. We need to never forget that. We need to never fall back and rely upon our own resources in order to live the Christian life or to conduct the Christian ministry. We need to know at all points and at all times we are weak, we are foolish, we need his strength, we need his wisdom, we need his guidance, we need his word. We need it read and preached and sung and prayed and displayed in the sacraments. We need to feed upon that word because apart from him, we can do nothing. It's vital that the disciples learn that then. If they are to carry on the legacy of Jesus, it's vital that we learn that now. We're in difficult times right now. The whole culture is moving in another direction right now. We need strength that we don't possess naturally. We need wisdom that is not ours by nature. And so the lesson they needed then is the same lesson that we need now. That our dependence is absolute. It is in all of life. It is particularly in the task of serving as fishers of men. And we cannot rely on our own resources. We must draw upon those which he supplies. And if we do, we'll have success. And I think that's the point of the 153 fish. That's an abundant harvest. He's letting them know, you will have success in what you do if you depend upon me, if you look to me, if you submit to my word, if you obey my commands, if you hear my voice. Even in difficult times, you will enjoy an abundant harvest. That's true in the first century. It's true in the 21st century as we pray together. Our Father in heaven, we pray, O Lord, knowing that we are foolish and weak. And oh, that we would not deceive ourselves with any notions of self-sufficiency, but that we might utterly rely upon your strength and your wisdom at all times and in all places. In Jesus' name, amen. Our concluding hymn is another hymn of praise. Wondrous King, all glorious, sovereign Lord, victorious.